Hey, Miles Lewis is with us. Let's do the thing, the intro. You know, let's do the intro thing. My phone just decided, the display just decided to die for the second time today while I'm looking up the questions for Mr. Miles here. That's okay. We know each other. We know what we know each other really well, and this is going to go really well. So here's the traditionalist intro. Somewhere. This is what editing was invented for.
Hey, who?
What? There we go.
Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Let me finish my potato chips here. And Miles, can you hear me? Whoa, there he is. Fade that on down. You there?
I am here.
Ooh, excellent. Well, for those of you who don't know, I wasn't here for the last 2 weeks. No, for those of you who don't know, Miles Lewis is the founder, chairman, whatever else you want to call it, of Anomaly Radio, Anomaly News Syndicate. That's still going, right, Miles?
Sort of.
Yeah, and Anomaly Archives, all of which we'll talk about a little bit, and various other things that I wrote down, which I can't see now because my phone died. So how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
I would like to maybe discuss, we're going to talk about other stuff that we've gone through recently, both of us, and something I heard today, which was quite interesting. But the first question was what is the Anomaly Archives? This is for neophytes. When did you start it? What's in it? And how'd you get a hold of that Bob Girard book collection?
Okay, well, the Anomaly Archives is the lending library of a 501c3 nonprofit called the Anomaly Scientific Anomalies Institute. It was founded officially with the IRS in 2003. In the years before, I had been accumulating more and more books on the subject of UFOs, parapsychology, weird phenomena of all sorts, and had just been reaching that point where I was accumulating more than I was able to read. And it seemed like, as awesome as that was, that it would be even more awesome to make those books available to other people. You know, since book owners tend to be the kind of folks that want to lend out books, so long as they get them back. And bibliophile, interested in anomalistics, Fortiana, ufology, and all foolish pursuits between those points, it just seemed like the right thing to do. You may recall in the wake of the non-conference, the 2001 National UFO Conference getting canceled due to the horrific events of September 11th, my friends who had helped me organize that, we started a local newspaper called the Austin Para-Times, and I did that for about a year or two after 9/11. And I'd been having this idea for an archive for a while, and I just at some point reached this breaking point where I was like, you know, this editorship of this awesome little newspaper was getting in the way of that other life goal, which was to found this lending library. And so over time, you know, it was inspired by the Archives for UFO Research, now called the Archives for the Unexplained, AFU, in Sweden. And it was inspired by them because they'd been around for years accumulating, you know, not just every UFO book ever published in as many languages as possible, but also the actual personal collections of famous researchers. And so over the last 10 plus years that the Anomaly Archives has been operating, we've been taking in greater and greater quantities the personal collections of friends of ours who were seekers in these areas, as well as just other fellow travelers on the sojourn of the strange. And most recently, last year, we were gifted with the Bob Girard collection that you referred to. And that came about because you may recall one of the speakers scheduled for that 2001 ill-fated National UFO Conference was a former top board member, a founding dude, one of the old-timers from MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, Tom Dooley. Tom Dooley had spoken at the San Antonio National UFO Conference in 1999, and we'd arranged for him to be one of the speakers at the 2001 conference. And so he knew me through that, as well as since years before that I'd run the local abductees experiencer support group. He knew about that and had contacted me years ago to see if I could help scare up some experiencers to participate in the still yet to be completed in the way of publishing their results scientific experiment known as AMP, the Abductee Monitoring Project. That was the effort to put a little black box with sensors into the bedrooms of abductees who were having regular experiences to try to quantify or learn some kind of information about what might be going on.
Tom Dooley did this?
Yep.
That is very strange. You mean former NSA employee Tom Dooley?
That's right.
Because I interviewed him for Project Beta. He was very nice and extremely helpful.
He's a very, very nice guy. Oh, hey, he helped us get this wonderful collection. So I have nothing but wonderful things to say about him. And he's always been really friendly. If I have actually met him in person, it was in San Antonio in 99. And yeah, he's one of the old guard of MUFON. He just this past year at the last MUFON conference, or I guess last year's MUFON conference, officially retired from the board. But he's been also a facilitator of what's known as UFORC, the UFO Research Coalition, which consists of KUFOS, FUFOR, and MUFON, the three old-school triumvirate of modern-era UFO civilian research groups in the United States. And
yeah.
That organization has a interesting history unto itself. It's not so much a formal organization, I think, as just a consortium of people from those organizations under a fourth name, so to speak. I do think that there's some connection to its birthing and history that connects, I think, to Bob Bigelow, which obviously is a controversial figure in the American UFO scene.
Yeah.
But anyway, Tom Dooley contacted me saying, hey, would you be interested in the personal collection of a notable UFO researcher? And he didn't tell me exactly who it was at first. But regardless of whom, I was like, well, of course, yes, that's what we're here for. And I found this rather interesting considering the fact that, you know, I knew MUFON had their own library. And even though they had moved around a lot due to the seemingly ever-changing lineup at the head of that organization over the last few years. And so I was just a bit surprised. But as it turns out, apparently Tom Dooley negotiated private donors to fund the purchase of two different Girard collections. The Arcturus Books, which was rebranded as the Arc Star bookstore online.
Yeah, and so
the ArcStar, is that I think what it's called? That inventory was transferred to MUFON, and MUFON now runs ArcStar Books as
their bookstore.
Whereas we, the Anomaly Archives down here in Austin, Texas, were the lucky recipients of this personal collection of Bob Girard. And Bob Girard, for those who don't know, was a rare book seller and collector who was fascinated by all things anomalous, and particularly with a connection to UFOs, and published since the 80s a monthly or thereabouts catazine, a catalog magazine, and a zine in the sense that it was, you know, mimeographed on a very low budget scale.
Though
it was for profit, which some people would disagree about the use of the word zine for that. But anyway, his catazine was a catalog where he would do these micro, these very acerbic micro reviews. He often
would
heckle, you know, some of the worst material that he was also trying to sell to you. And so he was putting this out for a long time, and he published his own books and did a lot of other little things that I don't know if a lot of people know about, that just show the various areas he was interested in, and the level to which he wanted to help get information out there. And one of the quotes by Klaus Svahn of the Swedish Archives for UFO Research said that he quoted Bob Girard saying, "My dream was to have one business in which the entire world's literature on these subjects was all under one roof." And so far, we've just about hit the halfway point on unpacking, inventorying, and cataloging and processing this 80 or so boxes of books from Bob Girard. And I think he was really well on his way to that life's goal of getting all these works of literature under one roof, because it's not just, you know, a UFO book collection. It's works on, you know, ancient civilizations, the classics like Atlantis, Lemuria, Mu, the ancient Celts and British folklore, from the fairy lore to the Druids and Stonehenge and other ancient sacred sites, to all the amazing other indigenous ancient civilizations around the world, and the mysteries and adventure that are conjured up when one looks at like the old pulp-esque Indiana Jones style adventure literature that he has a good collection of, as well as the contactee literature, as well as quite a bit of material on World War II, Hitler and the Nazis, to stuff on the Knights Templar, and lots of stuff on early Christianity and Gnosticism, and just it's all over the map. The material that, you know, every box I open up is just filled with amazing materials. And it's also amazing, as I go through these, so many of them are, you know, autographed specifically to Bob Girard, thanking him for helping the authors sell their books, because he was in communication with a lot of these authors. He was the one aspect of the zine quality of his catalog catazine.
There you go.
Yay, it's official.
Yeah, this is like, what, 15 minutes into the show? Wow. Anyway, go ahead.
Is the DIY nature of all of this, the zines that he was helping distribute, including my own. That's how I, you know, briefly encountered him, because of our mutual friend Wes Nations, who was publishing Crash Collusion, was like, if you're going to publish a zine, you need to, you know, contact Bob Girard. Yes. He'll help you, you know, get it out to a wider audience. And indeed, he did. And that just that DIY quality of you know, just helping other people get their efforts, their creativity out there. So there's a lot more, I guess, I'm still learning about Bob Girard. I never really got the chance to interact with him as much as others did, and so I'm still hoping to pull in and hear from others about their memories of communications with him. You know, he definitely had a certain reputation for being cranky about like book sales, because he, you know, definitely struggled with trying to make a living at it in the face the changing, you know, digital landscape with the rise of the internet happening, you know, towards the end of his life. So,
yeah, I didn't realize, you know, you don't realize that he had such a wide ranging interest base. I thought all the stuff that was in his catalog, catazine, as you call it, was just stuff he was selling. But the thing was, if you read, you know, I was stupid. If you read what he was writing, he knew what he was talking about when he was reviewing stuff. And he, you know, his nice reviews were, this is great stuff, please read it. But his bad reviews were the ones everybody liked.
Right.
Especially the Cito's New Friends review, which I wanted to republish.
Uh-huh.
I said, could I wrote to him, I said, Bob, could I please publish your Cito's New Friends review? It's wonderful. And he said, I can't remember. For some reason, I think he said okay. And then he wrote back, and this was by mail, too. It wasn't email. He wrote me another letter right before I was going to, you know, go take the thing to the printer. And he said, no, don't. I changed my review. I was like, okay. Well, and his second review was so much less nasty. I remember the last line in the review was lock this book in the gun cabinet so the little kiddies don't blow their heads off.
Yep.
But yeah. I did not know he had such a wide-ranging, you know, but like I said, it was obvious if you read his reviews that he knew whereof he spoke, and he knew about a lot of subjects, especially paranormal subjects, of course. And to some extent, maybe not to some extent, but to a great extent, esoteric religion and Western occultism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He included books on that, and he wrote his reviews knowledgeably on them. So, I never really thought about that. Anything that have you found anything in there in those book boxes you've opened that has surprised you yet?
Not really. A lot of it's surprising that I just hadn't seen so much of it. There is quite a bit of Spanish language material. His wife was Spanish, and
Spanish?
No,
Hispanic. Oh, okay.
Latin American. I'm not sure specifically
what country. Okay.
Yeah. But the
name was Maria.
Or Monica?
Oh, is it? Okay.
But, you know, the thing that surprised me was finding out, I guess, that he was really interested in the contactees. Now, I'm not sure how much of that interest was more just as a collector than actually, like, you know, he definitely wasn't a believer in the contactees.
Yeah.
As far as being literal, you know, in encounters with extraterrestrials or whatever these things were. But because and this is the thing, I only after acquiring this collection read his book, Future Man, A Synthesis of Missing Links, The Human Infestation of Earth, and the Alien Abduction Epidemic.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's part of me that really wants to believe that this is like a modest proposal and not real. And it's not really a UFO book in the classic sense that, you know, there's the references to, you know, UFO cases or UFO research. It's really thin and few and far between. And the thing that disturbs me the most is that he seems to give such credence to David Jacobs, who, you know, has so recently been completely and utterly discredited as far as somebody, an example of somebody who's, you know, really overstepped the bounds pushed a perspective that just seems so, in my estimation, off the mark when it comes to the true nature of the phenomenon. And so in that sense, it's hard for me to take it seriously. And one of the more disturbing things, which I guess I knew because I'd seen from various sources online in referencing Girard, is he was an advocate for massive depopulation. That's not to say that I think he wanted everybody to be
round up people in camps, but he meant by attrition.
or by the phenomenon itself.
Oh, I see what you mean.
He seems to have believed that in the ancient astronaut theory, you know, of extraterrestrial intervention in our evolution, and that we had not only that they had engineered different races before, and that it was inevitable that that when they engineered the next one, we would be made extinct, and that the infestation of Earth, as he referred to, would be dealt with. And it's an interesting book, definitely. But it's basically putting forth this idea that human consciousness can be evolved and expanded, and we can go to some other level. But it's not so much about that in a kind of in the way that New Age works. Talk about that in terms of, you know, let's all start, you know, meditating and expanding our consciousness. It's more like, no, they're going to force it on us, and those that survive will be completely unlike those that are, you know, not alive anymore. It's kind of radical, and there's I forget the title, but there was the book he did before that, The Revolt of the Free, which I think is even more about that. But the thing with I'm pretty sure he identified with Christianity to some degree, and was obviously very fascinated with belief systems and religions. But when it came to just mainstream religions, he really felt like churches and governments were just all filled with liars that had misled humanity. And not that I disagree with that. So
right, exactly. he just expressed it in a way that that guaranteed most people would not listen to him. Unfortunately,
yeah. But he was even cited by James R. Lewis, who writes those textbooks on UFO religions and that sort of thing.
The State University of New York guy,
I think so, and. Girard was described as the Marcel Proust of Proust of the UFO phenomenon by John, and partly by virtue of the fact that he was writing so many reviews of books of the time,
yeah,
that it's kind of like a history of that. And actually, interestingly, along those lines, in researching about Mr. Girard in preparation for receiving this collection, I discovered that the Sign Historical Group, who also did the Sign Oral History Project, that was that group of ufologists who got together and tried to track down a lot of the classic collections that have been donated to different archives around the country and collected their own material. They, at their website, Sign Historical Group website, sohp.us, they have PDF versions of all the volumes of a life's work by a man named Loren Gross.
Oh, yes.
Wrote this UFOs, A History, The Fifth Horseman of the Apocalypse. And apparently, I don't know if how many of these Bob helped publish, but Girard apparently helped Loren Gross published several of these volumes. So he definitely, was, again, in the, I think, that DIY sense, do-it-yourself, was trying to help others, actualize their dreams and their efforts and get their information out there.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've come across a couple of zines. I unfortunately did not get very many items of people's newsletters and magazines.
Well, you still got some boxes to go, don't you?
Yeah, but they're pretty well labeled. His wife amazing job of packing these materials, and we do have a partial inventory which totals about 1,300 items. But so far, there's been hundreds that weren't on this list, so it's going to be easily 1,500 or more items total. But there have been a few, I'm blanking on the, there's a particular old parapolitical countercultural zine that's autographed to Gerard and talks about, you know, hey, I can't wait to see the latest, you know, catalog. And oh, Scott Corrales is another person that he apparently Gerard helped get Corrales's Chupacabras research out there. And so I know that Gerard touched a lot of people, so we're really hoping over the next year to try to reach out to people and get more feedback and maybe some of their personal correspondence with him, just to try to fill in some of the gaps in the history and do as good a job as we can archiving, you know, his influence on the field, such as it was. I mean, you know, it's I think his influence was mostly in helping network with people. I don't think he necessarily had any groundbreaking idea that, you know, is going to help us completely understand the phenomenon. But maybe through understanding his beliefs in the phenomena, we might learn something. So,
right. And, well, just all the stuff that he had and that you got for the Anomaly Archive. But how many volumes are in there now?
I think we're right around 700. We have a searchable catalog on the website, anomalyarchives.org. And there's links to the catalog online on this in the sidebar, including one that's specifically focused on the Bob Gerard collection, which, like I say, I think we're up to about 700. So we're around halfway through. And this next week, I am going to push so hard to get the rest of this unpacked and cataloged, because again, we are indebted to Tom Dooley and to the UFO Research Coalition. Tom went above and beyond in so much as he, you know, personally paid for the transportation of the materials and the storage of them until such time as we're finished processing.
So. Wow, very helpful. Okay, one of the other things that I wrote down. That I remember I wrote down was not too many people know, because nobody really said too much about it, that you were a member of the Roswell Slides Research Group, which is, if people don't know what that is, it's the group that basically took the Roswell Slides, or so-called Roswell Slides, and said, this is very easily readable. It's a mummy of a two-year-old child, which has been proven over and over and over again. How did you get involved with that? Paul added me to the group, and then I didn't pay attention to it because I said, these slides are BS and I don't want to have anything to do with it. But how did you get involved?
It was luck. Again, yay. friends with Kirk Collins on Facebook, who had, you know, been creating one or two discussion groups. Mostly, you know, just, you know, insiders laughing at all the idiocy that's so rampant in the UFO scene.
Shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, it's really no contest there. But, you know, I don't know, to let off steam, because it's like, you know, we all have this interest in these phenomena to a greater or lesser degree of belief.
And we're all a little frustrated, or a lot.
So. Yeah. And it really helps to, you know, have people that, you know, have a lick of rational sense, you know, that you can commiserate with about the people who don't. And the slides had obviously been being discussed for a couple of years, mostly in the blogs of a number of people who I'm not actually going to name, but the people who many of the people that involved in the Roswell Slides Research Group, you know, had just been hanging around these blogs and paying some attention to the story as it unfolded over the last couple of years. And at some point, this group of Facebook friends decided to, you know, they were already like, the people were already trying to use what little they had to go on, which was that blurry screen grab from the trailer, that the Kodachrome trailer that Adam Dew had put out. And even from that terrible piece of quote unquote evidence, they were, you know, trying to track down the actual mummy or where it was taken. And even before the Roswell Slides Research Group was officially created, the group in the other Facebook group was I thought getting really close to finding the mummy. I mean, I was really impressed with what they're doing. And then somebody, either Jose Caravaca, I think, suggested that they form a specific group to focus on that effort.
Yeah.
And it got created, and I was invited, but somehow I didn't get in the first time. And then by the time they're like, oh, wait, hey, you know, we forgot to give your permission or whatever. And so I got in there, and, you know, they did all the heavy lifting. They did, they had already been searching, as I say, for any possible leads to the identification of that particular mummy. And then, I was mostly just there as an extra set of eyes to look around for stuff or to give feedback on stuff. I've been characterized as the most believer amongst them, perhaps the least skeptical in that regard. And I think that's probably true, demonstrably so, probably in a number of ways. But I just felt that they were really tenaciously going after this and doing a good job. And when the actual May 5th Cinco de Mayo Be Witness event occurred, I was live texting with several of the members a few of which had paid for the streaming version, and a few others I think had found interesting ways of watching it.
Yeah.
And so we were all just texting each other back and forth about what was being said, and sending each other screenshots of what was being shown. And that was a really fun and interesting, but incredibly boring.
Yeah. It was like 5 hours, I think.
Yeah, it was ridiculously long. And, it was an interesting exercise and certainly something to be witness to. But, yeah, it was pretty, pretty boring. But, within a couple of days, a slide and a higher quality image than had previously been available was found. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah. And the more technical folks in the group who had already been trying, with the really crappy screen grab to de-blur and find some useful evidence in these images, did so. And as the story goes, within a number of hours vary. I've heard, 72 hours. I've heard 2 hours. For me, it was like waking up in the morning, they're going at it. And a few hours later, it's like, wait a minute, is this a joke? That image is so easily readable.
Yeah.
I witnessed the communication of members of our group with Adam Dew to say, hey, this is what we're getting. What do you have to say to this? And him saying, calling us trolls and hoaxers and posting. And that's along with that, posting a better quality or at least the same level of quality of the image that we had obtained, which was a good way of us to go, well, okay, now we can, show provenance where we can do what we just did with this other image.
Right. He said, you don't have the right image. This is the right image, and sent you a high resolution, or sent Jose or Nablator of a high resolution image.
And he actually posted it to his own website, which
right. Okay.
And, but he also said that we were liars and hoaxers. And, I was looking at the time.
I don't count myself part of the group really, cause I didn't do anything except go, wow, they actually figured it out really quick.
I only consider myself part of the group because they were nice enough to list my name.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when I look at the interchange of what was going on, people, there were like, there were calls of like, hang him or whatever, and you're just like, come on. So yes, I consider you as more of the and they named you as such as the conscience of the group. It's like, calm down. We're just trying to prove that something is not right here, and nobody's out to make anybody look bad. We just want everybody to realize that this is what this is dispassionately, which is, I think that's very valuable. That was valuable in the group.
And it's interesting because, of course, so much of this has played out in the social media sphere, and that arena does tend to engender heated exchanges, and that's been the hallmark of the criticism of the Roswell Slides Research Group and associated skeptics. And that's the thing. I really don't get the sense that the perpetrators and promoters of this slides fiasco, they don't really seem to have a real good grasp of who of the many players involved and the fluid nature of the, you know, crowdsourcing approach to the investigation. And there's been a lot of misinformation out there. You know, they were able to capitalize briefly on the idea that that we had somehow faked the placard, and that, you know, versions of the placard or different versions are circulating that are in fact fabrications, and so far I've not seen any evidence of that. There's been images of that placard that were obviously manipulated to help illustrate like the deblurring itself, but not being claimed that this was actually the deblurred version. And but all of this is just kind of ridiculous, because as anybody who looks at those photos can see, they are clearly you know, images of a artifact with being displayed among other artifacts, and there are details in the background of the picture that clearly link it to the place that it has been identified as having originated from, or not originated, but one.
Where it was at the time the picture was taken.
Yeah, and you know, I think most rational people will have no problem, you know, accepting that there's really a down-to-earth explanation about this slightly odd-looking mummified child. You know, I grant you, I have not seen that many mummies. I've seen a lot more this year than I have in any 2015, you're the mummy. And it does seem like there's a lot of mummy stories in the news this year, but I'm sure that's just, you know.
Yeah, I know, Miles. You noticed I've stopped commenting or saying anything anymore either, because once it was solved, I kind of didn't care anymore. But the important thing was, and I looked at a couple places online, and people were saying, I can't believe that Ronnie Mysterioso is wasting their time with this stupid thing that was a big circus. And it's like, no. The reason I don't think it was a big circus was that after the release about from the research group that the slides definitely or almost definitely, and you know, evidence continued to pour in afterwards and continues to do so, that this was a perfectly mundane thing. I witnessed people saying, wait a second, some of these people are at best deluded and at worst maybe trying to get money out of people specifically and kind of ignoring, well, a lot of people shouted fraud. But the point was that people that had followed, you know, people like Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, to a lesser extent, and Chaime Masson, and I guess to a lesser extent, people like Brigalia and Richard Dolan, because of their participation in it, they were saying, wait, maybe some of these people aren't really, occasionally, not critical enough.
Yeah.
Or maybe in the case of Dolan, if you want to give him some credit, did not get to see enough of the thing or request enough of information or clear information before they made up their mind. And to me, that was important because it switched a few people over to saying, wait a second, we got to look at things critically. And that's really important. I don't think that's a hallmark of almost, you know, of almost any UFO group, or at least not that. It's not the hallmark of the loudest UFO proponents, I don't think. The people that are a little more circumspect, quiet, like Chris Rutkowski, who's part of the Roswell Slides Research Group, or you or Nick or anybody like that, people that are a little, you know, step back and say, let's not be emotional, let's see what's going on first before we figure out, you know, don't make a judgment yet. And I think that pulled a few people into that camp, realizing, well, you have to look at things critically. You have to look, get as much information you can yourself,
and to take things, you know, with a grain of salt, especially crazy, you know, seemingly earth-shattering revelations, taking them with a grain of salt until you can find out more information on them. And that was a good lesson from this, and that's why I thought it was valuable, and that's why I talk about it.
I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned from this incident, and I think, you know, any kind of anything can be a learning or teaching
Especially when somebody's wrong or you lose. If you lose, if you choose to take it to heart, you learn a lot.
And, you know, there was definitely some things that Paul Kimball said on y'all's roundtable discussion when all this broke that I really started seeing, you know, this is, I think, a real opportunity. And I was starting to see some bridges being built between quote-unquote skeptics and believers, and it seemed like there's the potential there still, I think, for some good to come out of this. And obviously, this fellow who's a member of MUFON, who's being openly critical, and one of those suggesting that these researchers not be given the opportunity to continue speaking at these types of events.
Yeah, specifically Mossan. Actually, I think he was saying, why is this person in particular being allowed to speak after all of this?
Yeah. And I think that's all of those things are good. And I think Kimball also, you know, pointed to the issues of these non-disclosure agreements and the whole entertainment industry aspect of the Adam Dews, you know, pursuit of the quote-unquote truth in regards to these slides, all in the aim of producing, you know, giving him the opportunity to express his creativity and perhaps pull himself out of the boredom, I don't know, of his career of, you know, doing sports highlight videos. And maybe this was, you know, his he thought this might be his swan song to greener pastures. I think it definitely is given a lot more opportunity for believers to take a step back and look at some of the people that may have informed their worldviews about UFOs and crash saucers and pickled aliens and made them, you know, go exactly as you say, like, you know, these people are often jumping to conclusions. You know, they since they're already dealing with what they think is the smoking gun case for UFOs, everything they see is, you know, a nail to their hammer. And I think they just let their belief carry them away in some regards. I mean, I still kind of vacillate between feelings of no, these people are, in fact, trying to pull the wool over people's eyes. But trying to give people the benefit of the doubt, I certainly can't prove that, it seems like a real comedy of errors that led to this ridiculousness. And at some point, it really hit home that, you know, these people who are continuing to indulge in the idea that there's some kind of mystery here are doing so on the backs of a dead Native American child, and that's the thing that's like, you know, I didn't go into this like all uppity about that, but you know, the more
a few people have mentioned that, and it's a completely legitimate and probably should be brought to the front of the discussion to shut it down at this point, because most people are pretty satisfied about what it is.
That's the way I feel about it. But you know, and that's one of the reasons I kind of, you know, was haranguing Whitley Strieber, because, you know, he's, you know, one of these people who I know a lot of people who've given up on him a long time ago. And, you know, he's somebody that for whatever reason, maybe it's because he's a hometown boy, so to speak, in terms of, you know, a number of his claimed experiences happened in San Antonio, where I was born. And, you know, so
there's sounds that. Like me talking about Bill Moore.
You know, and I've interacted with him a couple of times, and just I've always just had a sympathetic place in my heart for him.
Me too, actually. I still do.
And I do too. And but at the same time, I really was just like, you know, every opportunity I had, I was just, you know, trying to, you know, point out
the
irrationality of some of this stuff.
Look, Whitley, I'm on your side, but take a look. Look at this.
And I, at least he has finally, he did, like, I guess, report on what Kurt Collins has made obvious, that the one of the supposed medical experts that was on the side of anomalous evidence associated with the body, I think his name is Richard O'Connor, has since recanted and basically said, no, it's a normal human.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, I think there is some progress being made still. But it is another example of where it doesn't matter. There's always going to be some people that, you know, are going to continue from this point on believing. And then there's going to be people who just come hear about it for the first time, you know, years from now, and will get perhaps suckered along, you know, anew.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that will happen as much. I tend to think that it's probably just going to recede in the background. I mean, I hope it does, but the lesson will not recede into the background, and that people will take it to heart. You know, and I hate to keep harping on it, but the thing is that I hope it was a lesson well learned, and that people can proceed along with that. You know, from that, and maybe, like I said, not listen to people and believe them right away, especially if it flatters your belief system. And the other thing I was thinking right when you said that, when you were just speaking now, was that the hair splitting that's going on at this point does not do anybody any good, especially the people that are trying to prove, you know, whatever they think it is, that it's something anomalous. Because I think a wider audience, even a narrow audience, like people who are interested in UFOs, I don't think they respond well to hair splitting unless it's, you know, it becomes something that becomes obvious later. And I don't think this is going to become obvious as anything. It's going to become obvious that it's what it is. It's something mundane. But I'm not saying this extraordinary evidence thing, but, you know, even a normal amount of evidence is not turned up. In fact, a normal amount of evidence in completely the other direction is turned up.
Yeah. It takes quite a contortionist belief system to adapt the growing evidence that this is what it seems to be. Nothing, you know, nothing too out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. There's another thing. There's this, like, dichotomy between believers and skeptics, and maybe that's breaking down. And I hate using the believer mode. I I don't know what else to use, but I guess fans and not fans or something like that.
Well, but I just, in a 15-year-old UFO dissertation that I just started reading, the author refers to some folks as sympathetic skeptics, and I kind of like that idea.
Oh, yeah. Some of the skeptics on that group are, you know, they scare me. They used to scare me more, but they scare me a little less now. I'm still a little bit guarded, but the thing is that when somebody has a point, they have a point. So, you know, somebody like, you know, Lance Moody, I've gotten into it with him a little bit here and there online about certain things. And he's intractable about things, and I'm sort of intractable on not all the evidence is in yet, to my satisfaction. So I'm going to be agnostic, or whatever you want to call it. I'm going to be agnostic about it and not make my decision yet. But he will say, not enough evidence has come in, so therefore it is a mundane explanation. And that's where I have a break with it. But people like that used to scare me, because I thought they were going to try and, you know, whatever, cut me down or make me look foolish or whatever. But the thing is, the only time you have to worry about that is when you're either, one, lying, or two, you're not secure in your opinion about something. And that's the only reason to be nervous about it. If you have a genuine interest in something, why not let somebody try and cut at it to see if it can hold up? Because if it doesn't hold up, what are you doing? Why are you wasting your time with it?
Yeah.
So that's you know, on a deeper level, meeting all these people, talking to them, getting to know them a little bit better. You know, some of them share interest in music and old radio and stuff with me too. So why should I shut that out? You know, I don't think they're trying, you know, I don't think they're trying to be sneaky, nasty or anything. They just, they have a certain opinion and I have a certain opinion, and they've pulled me a little bit more in their directions. Like, I'm going to be even, I think I'll be even a little more critical about things at this point. But, you know, if you've listened to the show in the last few weeks, Miles, the last few times, I don't think, you know, people I've had on or I almost really care about that kind of stuff anymore, whether something's believable or not. I don't think that's important anymore. What do you think? If you know what I'm talking about. I mean, real, so. What's real, what's not real. What's important is perceptions, definitions, language, the way the human brain works, how we tell stories, how we perceive things, how we communicate things. That hasn't really been looked at. And that, I think that's a really important part of this. Not saying that, you know, George Adamski was a liar, or, you know, Pascagoula was a hoax or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Well, it goes back to just the basic ideas of myth, that, you know, it's these beliefs and these stories that affect how we actually live our lives. And that's something that, you know, Vallée said that it's not so much, you know, what the UFO does, but what it does to us. You know, how it affects the individual and then the community through social forces. And that's one of the reasons I've always been enamored with his control system hypothesis, and why I've leaned towards some idea of this as being a natural phenomenon, in the sense that it's part of our ecology on this planet.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't saying, you know, anybody I've had on, or I, or you, or anybody, is, these are not, definitely not unique ideas or new ideas. Vallée and to a lesser extent a lot of other people, Keel, Greg Little, God, who else? Even I guess like people like Daniel Pinchbeck and people like that, Terrence McKenna, have been pushing this stuff for a while. It's just that nobody really talks about it in a popular way.
Yeah, I think most of it goes on in dissertations and higher level writing.
It is, some of this stuff is difficult to deal with, and you have to sit there and think about it for a while. Like when I will read something that I admire, some of Vallée's stuff, Bruce Duensing's stuff when he was writing, even some of the people I just mentioned, like Greg Little and Vallée, even I will have to sit there and think for half a second about what they're saying, because I think, as Bruce Duensing said when I interviewed him, people don't like complexity. And I think you have to deal with the complexity. You have to deal with complex ideas to start to get a handle on what we're talking about here, about human perception and the subconscious and myth, as you say. These things are important. They're really important parts of the equation when you're talking about it, not just UFOs, but anything that's anomalous, that's not in normal human experience. It's the answer probably lies in a complex examination of the problem, and probably a lot of complex examinations. Wouldn't you say?
I think we just need a lot more varied perspectives. Brought to bear on these experiences and encounters and the what little physical evidence is left behind, but mostly the social and psychological
factors.
Yeah.
What I was going to mention earlier, that I said at the beginning of the show, something that just happened, on the Writing Mysterioso site, a group on Facebook, somebody was listening to a radio show with Peter Robbins and a podcast, Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan. And they mentioned, I think, me and Paul Kimball, my name, saying that we were calling for a reboot of ufology, and there's no reason to do that.
Yeah, I've seen the post, but I haven't had the chance to listen.
I haven't had a chance to listen either, because I was driving up to see, you know, my father-in-law here with Sigrid, and I saw this when I was coming back, and I haven't listened to it yet, but apparently they called us out by name, and then the host said, well, why don't you guys have a sit down and talk about it? And at first I was kind of like, and then I was thinking, well, why not? You know, I genuinely like those people. They're nice people. They're smart people. I don't happen to agree with them on some things.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to talk to them about it in, you know, in a non-threatening way. And I think I would like to do it. But the thing is, I don't think I've ever called myself, has ever said there should be a reboot. But what I've said was get rid of big UFO groups because they don't really do any good.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think we may be witnessing some sort of reboot in, you know, outside the control of anybody's intention, just organically happening. Yeah.
Yes, perfect.
And, you know, I think that's kind of the kind of crowdsourcing aspect to what we saw with the Roswell Slides Research Group, which really, you know, there were so many other people doing their own attempts at the same kind of thing, just trying to find, you know, can we find the body? Can we find the location that these photographs were taken?
Right.
It's the classic kind of thing that crowdsourcing can be very useful for. And so there are a lot of aspects, I think, of just basic UFO investigation that could be benefited by that kind of open source collective detective investigation, cyber sleuthing. But, you know, I think it's you know, it's not necessarily a replacement for any kind of organizational approach, but I think we've seen some of the benefits of that. But if it's going to really evolve, it's going to have to respond to the nature of the phenomena, which I'm still not sure, you know, where we're at looking at it in terms of a continuum of types of encounters and how it may have changed in the past and where it is now and where it may be going. I mean, there a number of people over the years have tried to quantify the eras of UFO activity, at least in the modern era. You know, there seemed to be a kind of a progression of reports, but really that is probably just the modern investigators forced patterning, you know, in trying to understand the data. But especially if you include, you know, a broad enough net that it's, you know, is it just about people perceiving communication from some seemingly non-human source? You know, does there have to be a glowing orb somehow present or, you know, a physical craft somehow present?
Right. Yeah. The thing is, yeah, I was just thinking about that. It's like, well, how do you separate out the, you know, the noise? It's kind of hard, but it means you're going to have to listen to a lot of noise.
And I think that's most of it's noise. I mean,
yeah, you're right.
You know, the whole the mantra of, you know, the 80% haystack being IFOs. Well, I think it's complicated by the fact that I think that 80% haystack actually generates, you know, the misperception and the misexperiencing of that 80% haystack, the IFOs, the, you know, oh my God, what is that thing? It's the moon, dude. It's Venus or whatever, you know, but people can still have dramatic, significant experiences that are based on a misperception.
Yeah.
And that can go on to, you know, create a new constellation of belief systems and contactee literature. And so it's all just so mixed up together. I think it's really difficult to try to weed all that out, to weed wheat from chaff. But.
Yeah, it is difficult, but there's so many people paying attention to all this stuff right now that it's like it's crowdsourced. It's a lot easier to find. It's a lot easier to get information or to find somebody that you know, found some little known thing that nobody knew about. Go Rightly actually just today, I think. Or was it yesterday? Posted. He's gonna answer me now. Posted a
the Sanderson, the Sanderson audio.
Yeah, a segment from an old Long John Nebel show where Ivan Sanderson is talking about Howard Menger telling him that there was a there was a some kind of strange being that looked like an alien that was being displayed in a Colorado museum, and this was in the 1950s. So, you know, I he's the first person to come up with that, as you know, even as Bregalia, who used to be part of the Roswell Slides promoter group, suddenly changed his tune and then started rabidly looking for information about a mummy in Colorado in the National Park Service Museum, et cetera, and found some information. But, you know, and a bunch of people in the group have, Isaac Coy, Coak, whatever his name is, he's found tons of stuff. But that definitely is the future, where you get a small, and I've been whining about this for a while, and you probably heard me, a small group of people working in secret to try and work out some problems and do some research, without the benefit, without the contamination of ego, media, publicity, anything like that. Because I think that eventually, when that stuff gets involved, a lot of good research starts going by the wayside. Remember that I brought it up on the show before, the Conjuring Up Philip book?
Mm-hmm.
I've read that book. I haven't read it in a while. But the people in that group were genuinely interested in the phenomena. They did not, you know, none of them had any precedence over the others, I don't think. They didn't have some agenda except to try and figure out what was going on. And none of them had book deals it was a time in history where there weren't TV producers out looking rabidly for stuff like this that was going on. They did eventually end up on a TV show, I think. But this is after 2 or 3 years of doing their research. And it was fascinating stuff. And it was a small group, a closed group of a few people concentrating on one problem for a while to see what could be done with it in a novel way, too. Make up a ghost and then try and conjure it up. And it worked.
Yeah, and that's, I wonder how much of this is physicalized thought form tulpas.
Yeah, well, whatever it is, it was a step in the direction of, let's try something, let's see if it works, and when we get results, let's share them with people. But not sit there saying, guess what we're doing, and, you know, we're going to write a book of this and become famous. It's like that you know, you've already stepped, you know, a many degrees away from actually solving your problem by starting out with that premise, I think.
I've got smoking gun evidence.
Yeah.
To be revealed in my next book.
Yeah, speaking of that, hey, Miles, why have you never written a book? Do you want to write a book, or do you have anything you would like to write a book about? Because I know you could.
It's writing is incredibly difficult for me.
Yes, it hurts.
Yeah.
It physically hurts.
I have gone through a few bursts of working on a UFO book or two, and keep threatening to do so. But you know, the more I really, it's mostly just going to be an overview of what I think is going on, and the various strains of that. I've, you know, when Mac Toney's passed away, that was one of the first kicks in the pants that made me realize I damn well better do it if I'm going to do it. And there's, of course, been a number of other people close to us who've passed over the last few years, with West Nation's passing last mm-hmm. year. And it kind of rekindled that feeling of like, wow, there's
you got a finite amount of time.
Yeah. You know, I feel though it'll mostly end up being kind of a an accounting of the Anomaly Archives, in the sense that, you know, the archives are largely made up of the materials that informed my perspective on these phenomena, and it comes down to this idea that there is a possibly non-human intelligence and consciousness at work in the phenomenon, and I tend to lean towards the idea of it being some kind of mechanism for potential contact among different types of consciousness that either there's just some natural mechanisms that can accomplish this, and or there's I think there's some naturally occurring mechanisms that enable different species to communicate non-locally and through parapsychological mechanisms of manifestation. I think that's the idea that's kind of nearest and dearest to my heart, and that one version of those of that consciousness that we could be interacting with is possibly a Gaian consciousness. But I also feel that there's also the false UFO phenomena that's been fomented by human agencies for their own stratagems and agendas, and that's really muddied the waters greatly in trying to apprehend what's really going on. And I think those are the two areas that'll be focused on in anything I try to write on this. But most of those ideas, you know, were not original to me. I became obsessed with these subjects and met people like you and the other Excluded Middle folks and West Nations and Go Rightly and others, you know, I just was able to see, you know, other people's research, and that sometimes they weren't even citing each other, but they're all kind of saying more or less the same thing. And yeah. I really feel like some possible solutions are already there, and there's, you know, good research that can be done to test some ideas. But yeah, I haven't written it yet. It's mostly just because life gets in the way.
Yes, that's exactly what happens. It's just it's really hard to write a book. It's probably one of the most difficult things you could ever do, I think. It might be harder than writing music. I do not know. I guess that's essentially what you're doing when you're writing, when you're producing anything coming out of your brain. You're basically writing music, quote unquote. People might not know this. I've known Miles since, what, 92 or 3, maybe?
Sounds about right.
Kind of a long time. And I think we first met at the MUFON conference in Austin. 90,
well, the first face-to-face, it would be that 1995 conference here in Austin.
Yeah, that was it, yeah. With the strange things happening at Wes's apartment after I left.
Yes, mysterious fires after mysterious men in black moving around.
Yes, and at the time we were doing, everybody was doing a zine. I think yours came about the same time, but Wes started up with Crash Collusion, and somehow we got in touch with each other. I guess it was because our stuff was on newsstands, and so we started writing each other and then getting in touch, and Go Rightly was in there quite pretty much right at the beginning. Paul Rydeen, Dave Reimer, the Excluded Middle people, Robert Larson and Peter Stenzel and I, and who was the other one? Kevin
Huddleston?
Yeah, Kevin Huddleston. And Mick.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that little group of ours. I think it was really. It's become really important to me as the years go on. It's like that. I don't know. I think that was the crucible for. I feel it, but all of us going off and saying let's continue doing this thing. We all like energized each other at the beginning, and I still hold that close as like that. That really was an important part of my life, I think.
For me as well, and that's you know, I hope to be able to work a lot of that into anything I write about this, because you know, most books on these subjects, you know, it all comes down to one's personal experience, and while I haven't had, you know, close encounters of the third kind or
yeah, me either,
full blown alien abduction experiences, it was the journey of discovery that was helped was facilitated by the help of you and that same group of kooks, and It was really an amazingly synchronistic time in my life, that's for sure.
Yeah, me too. The other thing I was thinking about when I was driving back today from out in the desert was that group of people, all of us, could easily have had some complete wackos in it, I guess. Well, maybe it couldn't have. But the thing was that nobody in that group, one, took anything too goddamn seriously. They could joke about anything. And two, they were open to just about anything, even really ridiculous stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And that really impressed me. It's like, I didn't know people could be like that. I thought they'd either had to be, that's what Excluded Middle was founded on. They either had to be, this is all BS, or they totally believed in all of this, and it was, to an annoying and insane degree. But none of the people were like that. They were all very circumspect, and the best part of it, like I said, was everybody had a sense of humor about it.
Yeah, and that's one of the qualities I've enjoyed through those Facebook groups I was alluding to. There's still that sense of fun and humor. Yeah, we need to go do some more camping, man.
Yeah, we need more kookaks, because we used to have it was called the Tex Euphornia Illuminati. and I think you probably do. I still have some T-shirts we made up for them. For our kookouts we have right now. Not campouts, but kookouts. And, some of the guys want to get together and do some of this stuff again, but it's, everybody's gotten older and life gets in the way, and, I'm free right now, so anytime we want to do it, maybe since I have the time, I should try and see when people would like to do this. And not in a virtual way, I mean, to actually meet up somewhere.
Yeah.
We'd either do it halfway. We did, I think, once in Texas, and maybe once here, once in California, once in Utah, or twice in Utah, once in New Mexico. When I hoaxed everybody with a flying light.
Yep.
Anyway. I'm just reminiscing, and I'm sorry if people in the audience are being bored to tears, but that was an important part of my life and really formed my ideas and how I felt about things later. And I'm really lucky to have met all those people, and you and everybody, and how how that stew came about. And I hope it can continue, at least in some form. And it kind of does, because we keep reaching out to other people and keep doing our things.
Yeah, we have a lot quicker communication now with the internet and everything. It's everything that was done snail mail before. I mean, it was really at the birth of that, and I think we really saw a lot of the zine culture move directly and quickly to the internet.
Well, it's a lot easier.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Instant gratification.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have to sit there. Yeah. You don't have to go down to the printers, and you don't have to pick them all up from the printers, and you don't have to do all the proofreading and then have a huge headache and want to kill yourself when there's three typos and stuff like that. You can fix it immediately. In my furtherance of let's stop complaining and provide ourselves some inspiration, I want to ask you, who do you like as researchers, theorists, commentators now on not just UFOs in particular, but anomalous things in general, ghosts, parapsychology, cryptozoology, etc. Who do you think is like this? These are people everybody should read.
Well, I don't read as much as I used to.
Okay, I mean, whatever formed. I don't, I can think of a whole bunch right off the bat, and they're just people I keep going back to. Maybe I should couch it in that kind of way. I mean, what's your inspiration, and what continues to inspire? Whose ideas? And we already talked about Valet, and everybody listening to this show knows about that. Both of us and our borrowing admiration and importance that he plays in our thoughts.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm.
Carla Turner.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly haven't read her in a long time.
Me either.
She was influential in my perspective on the abduction phenomena. Even though I think she
was literal about it.
Yeah, she was literal about it, but she gave a lot of points of entry for further expansive thought about it.
Yeah,
there was stuff that she was doing that I was highly dubious of, the what seemed like the excessive use of hypnosis. But again, I think she was asking the right questions, and she was very critical of the other abduction researchers, which I think that criticism has borne out tenfold, unfortunately, for all the abductees that went through those hypnosis mills.
I've never heard that term. That's a good one.
Let's see. Right now I'm reading, one of our mutual listeners, Stephanie, brought to my attention this dissertation that I was referring to earlier, that's circa 2001, and it's, a very academic type of paper called Taken Constructions of Race, Biology, and Colonialism Informing the Alien Abduction Narrative in the United States. And the thing that why Stephanie brought it to my attention was because she interviewed over 40 African American abductees, and that the author of the paper from 2001 called Taken, which is a reference, I'm pretty sure, to Carla Turner, and she does cite Carla Turner in the introduction, which is as far as I've gotten so far.
Is this online?
No.
Oh, okay.
It's obtainable through interlibrary loan, and but the author in interviewing these 40 African American abductees said that there seemed to be a distinct lack of trauma as compared to the Anglo-European white abductees.
Right.
So I'm really looking forward to seeing, more about that, because that's just been such an under-investigated area, and that a number of people over the years have commented about the distinct lack of African-American abductees. I mean, that's not to say that there haven't been any. Obviously, the most famous case involved an interracial couple with the Betty and Barney Hill case,
right.
And
that was before all this stuff,
right? And I've certainly seen a number of black abductees describe their experiences, but that's still significantly fewer than one would expect if this is across the boards, which may or may not be the case. But and that author, she's, I think, since changed her name and is a co-host on the author of this dissertation has changed her name and is a co-host on the Church of Mabus show opposite Jeffrey Pritchett.
Uh-huh.
But I'm really just that's what I've been so excited to be waiting for this this dissertation to dig into. And so far, I've not been disappointed.
One of the listeners, Sue Johnson, wants to know what the name of the dissertation is again.
Taken, Constructions of Race, Biology, and Colonialism Informing the Alien Abduction Narrative in the United States. The author was Carol Suzanne Matthews. She was doing her work at University of Kansas, and this was her resulting dissertation. And, but, so far so good. The introduction is mostly, giving a good introduction and overview of the then current state of UFO research, abduction research, and really, really seems like a really good overview so far. But like I said, the main reason I'm interested in it is because of that focus on the that particular ethnicity.
Yeah, I mean unheard of. In fact, when I interviewed everybody's friend, Richard Boylan, in the 1990s, I asked him the same questions, like, why are all the abductees basically white? And he said they're not. There's things going on in other communities. And I said, how do you know that? I think he's, I said that. And he said, well, because I've talked to people or heard people. I said, well, then why don't we hear about it? And he says, his answer was actually pretty, made a lot of sense. He said, who's doing the abduction research? White people. White people aren't going to habitually go into black communities and start asking them if aliens have taken them anywhere. It just, it's a non-starter. So I kind of thought, that's a legitimate answer. Yeah. But I wish somebody would do that. And it sounds like, you know, many years now that they have. Well, that's good. That's quite a long paper. If I was reminded of cyberbiological studies of the imaginal component in the UFO contact experience.
Yay! Love that one. That's probably my all-time favorite UFO book title.
Yeah, mine too. And one of my favorite UFO books that I forget to mention, because it's not really a UFO book like somebody wrote it. It's a collection of papers.
Yeah.
That not many people paid any attention to when it came out. It was very little known and not very well represented. But and well, they didn't print too many of them. I guess who printed it?
Dennis Stillings, and it was the
Arceus Project.
Arceus, yeah.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I was recently reminded that Stillings had some connection to this company called Medtronic, which at least one person on the internet thinks is somehow connected to, you know, alien abductions, as far as like possibly being one of the MyLab instigators. But
yeah, what it's funny. I've got such a such a noise filter that I know I'm missing a lot of stuff now. I mean, I start missing stuff that's helpful because my noise filter is so. What's the word? It's sensitive now. Way too sensitive.
Well, there's just been so much of it. You've had, you know, we've all had to put up pretty high fences to keep out the riffraff, you know.
keep the riffraff out of our brains, because then you start going down a rabbit hole. Well, that's the other thing. It's as you get older, it's just a normal thing. As you get older, you start saying, I can see that coming down the street, you know, 10 miles away now, and I'm going to steer away from it. But the thing is, you can't see what's behind the head of the parade. The head of the parade might be some idiot, but something behind it might be actually kind of interesting. So, you know, you go, what a bunch of crap. And then, you know, days, weeks, months later, you're like, oh, wait a second. That group of people or that person actually had something to say that was valuable. And at first I just thought, yeah, what an idiot. But the thing is, you find out that actually most of the time you're right. I guess. But that's the value of the social media, is that some people can say, well, you know, did you check this out? Did you check out this part of it? And that becomes, you know, your BS detector gets a little more finely tuned, or maybe not as finely tuned, and lets a little bit more in just because of the fact that somebody else doesn't have the same BS detector that you do.
Yeah, I still see way too much BS, though.
Well, I do, too. I'm afraid I'm going to miss good stuff, but the thing is, when I stop being afraid I'm going to miss good stuff, so much garbage gets dumped on me because I let it.
It's one of the things I was really appreciating that Isaac Coy was doing there for a while, of cataloging all these hoax videos that are just so rampant, and just, you know, you'll see the same one every, you know, couple of months, and it's just like, at least now there's a pretty good directory that he's created where you can go, boom, there it is. Look, here's the explanation. Here's all, you know, you don't need to go waste any more time on this nonsense. Here's where that, you know, is sourced to move on to something better. And I think it's collections of easily navigable bunk,
I think that's helpful. I used to think, like, why even bother? Most of these videos are BS anyways, particularly, you know, from probably the 1990s on, and especially around 2000 on, because software keeps getting better and better and better. But just because it's not important to me doesn't mean it's not an important service. So, yeah, I mean, if, you know, 3,000 people are going to look at his list or just ignore it and say, you know, he's just a debunker. But 6, 8, 10, 20 people will look at it and say, oh, you're right. That is total BS. You know, more importantly, I think that people like videos and stuff, but I think we got to get to the point where I've stopped watching any videos or looking at pictures because they can be faked so easily. Who cares? And besides, what does it prove? It's just porno.
Yeah, well, again, with the recent slide stuff, it was never going to be proof of an actual alien because yeah. It's just a freaking picture.
Yeah, it's proof of something that most people, the vast majority of people, don't think exists in the way, or at least the people who create public opinion, believe exists in the way that the people that were presenting the slides. It's like trying to prove something. It's like, here's a picture of something that a lot of people don't believe exists. Well, what does that prove? It's just going to say, that's a picture of nothing. That's a picture of something that my reference is doesn't exist. So what difference does it make? It's like people saying that, if you had this much evidence for abductions, you brought into a court of law, that there would be a slammed, it was an open and shut case. No, it wouldn't. You're trying to prove something that almost nobody in the population has experienced and nobody in the population can experience on demand. So you're trying to prove something that doesn't make any sense to most people. So what kind of proof does that? It offers no real proof. It's just kind of proof to people that, one, believe it in the first place, and two, might have gone through some of the same experiences and can reference whatever's in that picture to what their experience was. Sorry, I'm not really asking questions. I'm just bantering back and forth. Go Rightly says, Jim Moseley had a black girlfriend who was a contactee. Her name was Barbara Hudson.
Awesome. Did not know that.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I didn't know that about Moseley. And there's a picture of her Gray Barker at Giant Rock, the book that Barker wrote, I think maybe with Moseley, about when they went to a Giant Rock convention, I think in 66 or 67 or something like that. There's a picture of Barbara Hudson sitting at a table selling Flatwoods Monster figurines. Remember that picture? And
so.
It's he did it on a he did it on a Xerox machine, on a photocopying machine, the at least the version I have, and you can't tell her race. It's just like this cute girl sitting there, like with her hands smiling, with her hands on these little figurines, and they're a little Flatwoods Monster, with the round head or whatever the head with the pointy top and the big glowing eyes and
the spade head,
huh?
The spade head.
Yes. And, yeah, I was looking. It's like, that's Jim Moseley's. Oh, no, it didn't even say it was his girlfriend. It just says, the pretty Barbara Hudson sitting with, Flatwoods Monster figurines for sale at the Giant Rock Spacecraft Convention. Maybe I can find that and scan it, and when I put the show up, or just put it on the Facebook page.
Absolutely. Must have.
Yeah, so I'll put that one up. Yeah, I did not know that about Moseley. You did know that he was trying to get in touch with this woman, this Peruvian woman that he'd brought back with him from Peru on one of his grave robbing things. I guess that they were going out for quite a while. And we found Sigrid and I found, he gave us an address and we found her like out in the South Bay here in LA. And she was a cat lady. She had like, six or eight cats living with her and was very reluctant to come out. And when she did, and we told her it was Moseley that we were talking to, she her face lit up and she started talking to us about it. We hung out with her for like 2 hours.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And she said, oh, he was so handsome. And you look at pictures of Jim back then, it's like, he looks kind of geeky.
Yeah.
He's got those big horn-rimmed glasses and he's kind of like, hey, how you doing? But she apparently thought he was a hot item, so I guess they were a hot item for a while. Anyway, we talked to her, and we came back to talk to her one more time a few months later, and I put her on the phone with Moseley. I called him and I said, Jim, she's right here, right now, and gave her the phone, and they talked for about 20 minutes.
Oh.
And after that, because she didn't have a phone in her house.
Oh, wow.
So I said, well, Jim, one of her daughters has a phone or a cell phone, so why don't you guys talk? And after that, he was able to talk to her, because I think he wanted to put her in his will or something. I can't remember what. Or he just wanted to get back in touch with her. But that's just this weird little thing about Jim Moseley that people don't know. And, it's nothing scandalous or terrible. I just thought it was a cute story about Jim Moseley.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. That's really great. Yeah, Man, I miss him a lot. And as several people have pointed out, boy, he really would have had a hoot with this recent slides thing. I mean, here.
Oh, he would have peed his pants.
Here was the original grave robbing ufologist. You know, he could have spoken out on this.
Yeah.
Oh well.
Yeah, somebody ought to do a fake version of a saucer smear just on their, you know, the special Roswell slides edition. I have a typewriter. I could probably do it.
That would be wonderful.
Fake letters from people. Misses from the masses, you know. Jaime Masson writes, "You're a charlatan and I hate you." Stuff like that. I did find my phone with all the questions, and I finally got it to work. And you know what? I asked you them all.
All right.
Well, not all of them. I did ask you what the Anomaly Archive was. Two of my other questions in there were, what's the Anomaly News Syndicate, and what shows are on Anomaly Radio, and how can people listen to them?
Oh, well, the Anomaly Syndicate was, I migrated the Elphys. Let me back up. The zine that I did, inspired by The Excluded Middle and Crash Collusion, was called ELF Infested Spaces, Elphys. Elf Infested Spaces, acronymed to Elphys. Elphys.net was the first website I ever, domain name I ever purchased. And so it was supposed to be like a network portal to all these weird ideas, and over the years, over the decades, I've accumulated a whole bunch of different domain names, many of which have the word anomaly in the title. And so at some point, I've always been, you know, doing some kind of publishing, either local newsletter, local the zine, or the Austin Para-Times newspaper, or the various website incarnations. And so there's one site, anomalynews.com, but I've really, over the last several years, haven't done much with it. But anomalyradio.com has been streaming in one form or another since late 2000. And it was created in anticipation and to promote the then upcoming National UFO Conference in 2001. So, the Anomaly Radio Network really was born out of something that was originally called Radio Free Elphys, after the newsletter Elphys. And in 2006 was rebranded as Anomaly Radio. And that's when I really started doing a much more formal schedule of different shows. Of course, you had been doing terrestrial pirate radio, and it migrated to internet radio as well to go along with that. And our friend Robert Larson and others, some friends locally, libertarian activists, Angela Keaton and others, were doing terrestrial and internet stuff. And just basically started doing the internet streaming ever since. And the Anomaly Radio Network has gone through periods of activity and hiatus. For many years now, I had been doing a show with our mutual friend Mac White, PsyOp Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much gone on hiatus, and Mac moved to Fort Worth, but we occasionally still do shows together via Skype. In fact, we're probably going to do another show real soon. And
excellent.
I was doing a solo show, Anomaly Radio Live, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. And, you know, people can listen through various internet apps. They can listen via their phone, even if it's not a smartphone. There's a phone number they can dial to listen to if they have, you know, unlimited minutes. And the different shows on right now, of course, Radio Misterioso is being streamed as we speak. Have been carrying that great show for a long, long time. And Raymond Wiley, who used to host Out There Radio, which started as a college radio, terrestrial radio show, has evolved into a new show called The Shadow of Ideas. We're carrying that. My local friend, the libertarian anarcho-capitalist activist radio show host, Scott Horton, not to be confused with the awesome constitutional rights lawyer Scott Horton, but who is often a frequent guest on the Scott Horton show. We have him on
Scott,
every day.
Scott Horton interviews Scott Horton?
Occasionally, yeah. You know, one is an angry punk rock pot-smoking skater, and the other is published lawyer, writer on all things civil liberties. We have a music show that I carry. It's a Mike Watts podcast. For those who are familiar with the Minutemen, one of the best punk bands of all time.
Yes, their LA bass band.
Mike Watt does the Watt from Pedro show. That's on every night after Radio Misterioso from midnight to 3 a.m.
Is he still doing that show?
Yeah.
That's sure amazing. You know, when I first heard he was doing that show was on KBLT on the Pirate Station.
Ah.
He had his Watt from Pedro show was on that station.
Wow.
And everybody's really proud. It was like, we got Mike Watt from the Minutemen. And now you have him. That's great, Miles.
And really, you know, I've really slacked off. I've really
doesn't seem like it to me, but
well, there's a lot of let's see, some of the other shows. Eric Davis's Expanding Mind we carry. Tim Banal's Banal of America.
Right.
Gareth Davies has a number of really great shows. The Mindset. And I just haven't been that active with it as much the last few years. Really, I've slowed down a lot. The last couple of years have just really made me much more reflective and tried to slow down because it just I'm older and I can't deal with the stress as much as I used to.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you start to filter, like we were talking about before. It's like, what is important to me? What is important to my quest? Whatever I want to know, the information I want. What's important to me on that level? And you get to the point where you think, if I'm not being paid for this, I'm going to be doing exactly what I want.
Yep.
I want to find out the answers that I want to find out. And you know, having a responsibility to do something like, you know, update your sites or run the shows or get guests or whatever, that is, you know, that's forcing yourself to do some seeking and some interacting. And that, I think that's what keeps you going. It's certainly what keeps me going. It's happening more often because my filters are just down to what do I need to know to make things more exciting for me. And if other people think it's exciting that, you know, or, and it's interesting and it's helping them, that's wonderful too. That's like icing on the cake.
Yeah. So my main focus has been trying to get the Anomaly Archives to be self-sustaining because I really do want it to be my legacy. If I do get around to writing something, that would be great. But, I think the idea of the archives is, something that I do think there's so much import in this phenomena and also in the history of people seeking for answers in it. And I think those individual stories of the seekers is often as interesting as the phenomenon itself in some cases.
Yeah.
So I hope that I hope I can, you know, really solidify the Anomaly Archives' future as a repository for such tomes of the many different researchers that I've benefited from looking into. And
do you have a jet going by? What is that?
I don't know. I was wondering what that noise was. I thought it was coming from your end, but
okay, go ahead. Sorry. It's the Men in Black trying to sabotage our search for self-worth.
So that's really where my energy has been focused, trying to concentrate on that. And And at the same time, keep a day job and a roof over my head.
Yeah, but, there's the challenge.
And been pretty lucky in that regard, you know, mostly first world problems, as they say. So
yes.
Don't want to complain too much. But and I'm hoping that, you know, once this Girard collection is finally completed, being unpacked and processed, we can have a nice open house and launch party, so to speak, for the whole complete collection. And hope to do a alt media 1990s zine scene exhibit, displaying some of the zines that I have in my collection, many of which really come from our friend Wes Nation's collection, since he was publishing Crash Collusion. And as you know, when you publish something like a zine, you're going to get lots of other people's zines, usually for trade.
Yes. So
we have a decent collection within the archives, and I think that's an interesting part of the modern era history of the UFO scene, is the DIY literature that was resulted from that, whether it be, you know, Jim Keith's Dharma Combat, Steam Shovel Press from Ken Thomas, to you know, our little group's various publications.
Off the Deep End, Tim Cridlin did that incredible zine for a while.
And what was the one that
Paranoia started out then?
Go Rightly. Oh yeah, and we've got several of the Paranoia and the their catazine, because they had a shop there in Rhode Island.
Right, that's right.
What's the one that Go Rightly was just recently posted a cover?
Murder
of?
Can Be Fun.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite zines, along with The Great God Pan.
There's some freaky stuff out there.
Just people are just, you know, there were no websites, so people would just say, this is what I'm into, and just, they would put this stuff together, you know, paste it up or whatever. I think Murder Can Be Fun was probably started out as a photocopied zine, but I think they went to some kind of primitive offset. And it was half size, it was 8.5 by 11 folded, I think.
Well, I just recently had the pleasure of participating in the Zine Librarians Unconference here in Austin.
What was that like? What happened? I saw you had a little post on it, and you had like pictures of some of the zines.
I'd never been to an unconference, and it's very free form. These are all, you know, technically librarians. I'm, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing. I'm not actually a librarian, but these are all really cool, hip folks who are interested in zines and who are also librarians in the library industry career path. And they've been developing, like, you know, a code of ethics and a new set of you know, metadata for cataloging of zines. And it's part of what's helped me realize that the zine scene is alive and well. And while, you know, nobody else there was a collector of anomalous phenomena zines like we are, you know, most of the zines that this crowd focuses on are, you know, from various, you know, oppressed groups who have, you know, taken to this as a medium to express themselves. And that's certainly an awesome thing in and of itself. And so there was also a zine book and comic festival here in Austin that same weekend. And so part of our unconference was actually going over to – it was held on the grounds of the French Legation, like the oldest structure or location in Austin, and was fantastic. There's so much – self-publishing going on now. And of course, you know, a lot of this is really high end and not what people think of when they think of, you know, Xeroxed, handmade, you know, short print runs of you know, very cut up looking, you know, homemade looking zine stuff. But it's just amazing that there's still that culture there. And I was really pleased to participate in that.
Yeah, well, it's that surprised me too. It's like, why would anybody print anything anymore? I don't want to do it again, but it's wonderful that they do. And like you said, they can you can produce so much higher quality stuff now with stuff that's available. Because we had Photoshop and what's that called, the layout program, the graphics program,
PageMaker?
No, the other one, the earlier one, the one that ran on a Mac. Some people are probably screaming it right now.
Oh, I thought that was it. I thought it was PageMaker.
Well, PageMaker came later, but first there was I can't remember the name of it. Wait, because Sigrid gets annoyed when I look stuff up online. what I call it? Page layout software print. Yeah, see, it's not even going to be on here because it's like AutoCAD and stuff like that. Yeah, see, it's not even going to be listed anymore. Quark Express, that's what I used. Wow. So, still there?
Yeah.
It was Quark Express. That's what the excluded middle was published in, or laid out in, was Quark Express. Huh. Yeah, Steve Ray just said it. So. Okay, I got started late, and I'm not going to blame you for that. Can I ask you one more thing, Miles?
Sure.
Where do you think things are going to go? Where do you want them to go? I've whined, bitched, complained, and wheedled and everything about what I think should be going on. What do you think about the state of, you know, people studying anomalies in general and UFOs in particular? And where do you think it's going, or where do you think it should go? I mean, it's a big question, but go ahead.
Well, I'd like to see what I've always wanted, which is a real attempt by the various sciences to look into these strange phenomena without the air of ridicule that seems to have so often surrounded it. And I'd like to see a higher caliber of researcher making the lecture circuit, and I'd like to see experiencers, you know, have more opportunity to participate in meaningful ways with the researchers, and I'd like to, I would hope that they could step back from their experiences enough to be a little more open, to have, as I always say, a higher tolerance for ambiguity and not just, you know, jump into a particular belief system because it's what they want to believe or what they've been led to believe by unscrupulous researchers. I don't know what the phenomenon is going to do. I'm really at a loss to say where it's at right now because I fortunately haven't been with, you know, I haven't had the chance to really hear from too many experiencers who aren't just completely caught up in the same belief systems that we were hearing about in the 1990s.
Or even before.
I know, yeah, or before. I think, you know, there are a lot of groups that have formed because of, you know, the ease of communications facilitated by these same technologies. There's a lot of, you know, Facebook groups that are made up of people who claim to have had these experiences, but it's what I've seen, what I have access to, does not impress me in terms of their ability to navigate these strange experiences and without falling prey to one belief system or another.
Well, what do you think could change that? Who could lead? What kind of person could lead a group where they wouldn't get stuck in that paradigm?
I think there's plenty of good people who could. I don't think there's too many people who have the patience. I think there's a lot of people who have the wherewithal to do it, but I don't know if, you know, it takes a lot of effort to listen to those stories, right. and not, you know, not immediately dismiss them. And I go back to Jerry Clark's, you know, quoting of some other researcher saying we ought to be able to believe the experiencers without believing their explanations.
Yeah.
You know, when I hear these crazy stories, I think, wow, that's a crazy story, but, you know, I don't know. It could be true. You know,
it's true to that person and the way they're describing it to you. And if it's not, you can kind of tell, I think, because they get a little wild eyed.
Yeah.
Most of them are just like, this weird thing happened. And well, at least the ones you want to talk to, this weird thing happened. I don't know what to make of it. And I want somebody to make me feel better about it. I want to be able to integrate it. That's what they're saying, I think.
Yeah, and you know, the easiest way to integrate them is to find you know, some semi-solid belief system to latch onto, I think, instead of, you know, kind of holding a few different ones as possible, but yet to be certainly proven. I hope something positive comes out of the recent fracas over the slides and the general lack of rigor that has permeated this community, such as it is, for so long. I don't know if that is really a reasonable expectation, but I've gotten glimmers, and I've seen just enough to make me think, you know. Maybe if I'm not overly pessimistic like I, you know, had been. Another mantra of late has been I'm uncharacteristically optimistic. There's been enough. As crazy and as frustrating as the slides saga has been, I just still come away feeling like something good is going to come of this. I don't know what that ultimately will be, but it does seem to have been a collective, you know, we can do better. Even the, you know, the people who I think, you know, were initially taken in by this have come away, I think, with the sense of, you know, this is a good example of, you know, the way things shouldn't be done, and we can do better. We can, you know, we can learn from perhaps the crowdsourcing, open source, collective detective approach to some aspects of these kinds of cases, and we can try to maybe hold some of these old school organizations accountable, and the more importantly, the researchers who you know, have succumbed to such idiocy. You know, I think. Maybe there could be, you know, some change here. That Mark O'Connell's, you know, talked to Jan Harzen about his desire to see such a change, and the fact that, you know, some radio hosts are suggesting it to people like Peter Robbins and Richard Dolan that there should be some kind of panel discussion. You know, I don't know if that will lead anywhere, but
no, but you can't just ignore somebody you don't agree with. You know, I don't think Richard Dolan is like that, particularly because he said, you know, I think Peter said that, but he tended to agree. And when I, you know, the times I've interacted with him, it hasn't been for a long time, but one time I said, you know, I read a lot of stuff in National Security State that I didn't agree with. And I think some of them were actually kind of wrong, because I've talked to people, and I think that some of the factual information in there, at least from my perspective and what I've seen, who I've talked to and research I've done, I don't agree with. And I said, do you want to come on the show sometime and talk about that? And he said, yeah, sure, no problem.
Cool.
Yeah, he actually, you know, and I'm sure he still feels, no matter what you think about his methodology or what he thinks now, or I think he's generally open to stuff, whether he agrees with you or not, you know, who cares? But he's open to some criticism. Then I don't know if it's going to make him change his mind, but whatever. So yeah, it would be nice to have more dialogue between various groups of people, because some people you're never going to have a dialogue with. Hardcore skeptics and hardcore, you know, UFO fans or believers, that you can't have a dialogue with them, because there's no such thing as dialogue. They're monologues. But if people are willing to listen to others and learn from them and take things to heart, I think that that might be the important thing.
Yeah, I think some more honest group discussions would benefit the community. We'll see.
Yeah. Okay, now I've held you to exactly 2 hours and made you stay up, and I hope that I didn't make you stay up too late, that you're going to be late for work or anything. It's after midnight where you are.
That's just it. I've actually taken the entire next week off to focus on...
Oh, that's right.
...hammering out the rest of the Gerard collection, so...
Oh, okay. Well, that'll be excellent. That'll be excellent to see. And, oh, if people want... the Anomaly Archives, this is a lending library, yes?
A portion of it, yes.
Yes. And you can do this by mail, right?
Not yet.
No. Not yet? Oh, I thought you had that.
No. That's in my day job, we deliver audiobooks to the blind through the mail and through the internet. But that is kind of a goal of mine for the future, but we need a lot more infrastructure.
Oh, okay. You still want me to read Project Beta to have in your collection for the... Or get somebody that can read properly to do that? I think you'd mentioned that at one point. It's like, that's a cool idea. I'd like to do that, or at least be involved in it.
Well, we can talk about that. I've wanted to produce UFO and paranormal audiobooks for a long time, but I'd have to talk to you about that off air. So.
Okay, we'll do that. All right, Miles. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, and I think we haven't talked off-show for very much in a while, and I think we ought to do that soon. I'm not doing anything. You know, I'm not working now. So I would like to talk sometime in the next week or two and see what's going on.
All right.
All right, Miles. So thanks for being on the show. People don't know... very long time friend of personal friend of mine in the show, and I said this last time he was on, helped great, people are texting me, helped Radio Mysterioso along very much in the first few years when he hosted and curated the Radio Mysterioso shows online, and that invaluable service, which I will never be able to thank him adequately for. So part of the reason that you're listening to this show now and it's still here is because of Miles Lewis. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, and I can't wait to talk to you some more.
Okay. All right, I do this with most people. If I ever get Valet on, I'm going to ask him what he wants. Probably classical music, wouldn't you think? An outro to the show.
Oh, right.
I will usually ask the guests what their preference would be, and then I try to find it online and either play it right now, live, or add it when I do the edit.
Oh, the Luden Brothers? Is that the guy?
Luven Brothers?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of the gospel.
Satan is real?
Yeah, or any of their stuff is awesome.
You like the Luven Brothers? Really?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that, Miles.
I like all saucer music. I mean, you know, that's how I got introduced to their material, is because of their...
You mean the Luven brothers? You mean the Buchanan brothers?
Oh, is that the ones that imitate the Luden brothers?
You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. That one?
That's the one I'm thinking of, but no, the other one you mentioned, Satan is Real.
Yeah, that's the Luven brothers.
I don't know. I can't tell the difference. I like that kind of... There's something about that I like.
Me too. Well, of course, you know what? One of their albums was called Tragic Songs of Life. I mean, how can you deny something that cool in the 1950s whenever it came out? Okay. Well, I will say thank you again as this motorcycle goes by. And if Satan is Real works, great. And if not, I'll just find it on YouTube and play it. Thanks again, Miles, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Take care. I love you.
Same back at you. See ya. Does it work? I think it's working. Excellent.
Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world every day. Satan is real, working with power. He can tempt you and lead you astray. I attended service at a little church in the country not long ago. A prayer was led by an old country preacher who then raised his hands as everyone stood and sang, "My God is real." A warm breeze through the open windows brought in the smell of new-mown hay in a nearby field, and the singing of birds could be heard in the moment of silence as the preacher opened his Bible to read. And then a little old man stood up, bent with age, his hair thin and white, and said, "Preacher, tell them that Satan is real too. You can hear him in songs that give praise to idols and sinful things of this world. You can see him in the destruction of homes torn apart. I know that Satan is real, for once I had a happy home. I was loved and respected by my family. I was looked upon as a leader in my community. And then Satan came into my life. I grew selfish and unneighborly. My friends turned against me. And finally, my home was broken apart. My children took their paths into a world of sin. Yes, preacher, it's sweet to know that God is real, and to know that in Him all things are possible. And we know that heaven is a real place where joy shall never end. But sinner friend, if you're here today, Satan is real too. And hell is a real place, a place of everlasting punishment. Satan is real, working in spirit. You can see him and hear him in this world every day. Satan is real, working with power. He can tempt you and lead you astray.
Okay, thanks again, Miles. Here's you got to play. You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers by the Buchanan Brothers.
You better pray to the Lord when you see those flying saucers. It may be the coming of the judgment day. It's a sign, there's no doubt, of the trouble that's about. So I say, my friends, you'd better start to pray. Of the judgment day. Maybe they were sent down here from Mars. If you just stop and think, you'd realize just what it means. They're more than atom bombs or falling stars. And though the war may be true, there's unrest and trouble brewing. And those flying saucers may be just a sign that if peace doesn't come, it will be the end of some. So repent today, you're running out. Saucer fly like a comet through the